Welcome to In Conversation with writer and editor Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life, a monthly chat with writers, publishers, and those who support the literary arts.
Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and welcome to our program, In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today, we're talking with Tina Tessina, who has been a licensed psychotherapist in Southern California since 1978. She's got over 35 years' experience in counseling individuals and couples and is the author of 13 books, which have been translated into 17 languages. Her books include It Ends With You, Grow Up and Out of Dysfunction, The Unofficial Guide to Dating Again, Money, Sex, and Kids, Stop Fighting About the Three Things That Can Ruin Your Marriage, The Commuter, Marriage, and her newest, The 10 Smartest Decisions a Woman Can Make After 40, and Love Styles, How to Celebrate Your Differences. She writes the Dr. Romance blog and the Happiness Tips from Tina email newsletter. She's CRO, Chief Romance Officer, for loveforever.com, a website designed to strengthen relationships and guide couples through the various stages of their relationship with personalized tips, courses, and online couples counseling. Online, she's known as Dr. Romance. Dr. Tessina appears frequently on radio. She has podcasts online and online videos. She also appears on TV shows such as Oprah, Larry King Live, and ABC News. Welcome, Tina. It's nice to talk with you today.
It's lovely to be here, Sheila. Thanks for inviting me.
For our discussion on writing and the writing life, you've got a lot to say, I think, about writing so many books and the thrill of having them translated into so many languages. When I read that, I thought to myself, wow, your books seem so in tune with Western culture and especially United States culture, where we're very interested in self-actualization and individualism and, of course, couples success. And I'm wondering what the other languages are, at least a few of them, and what countries these books are popular in.
Well, they're all the European languages, Italian and French and Spanish and Greek. But some of the other ones are interesting. Indonesian, Polish, Estonian, Chinese, Japanese, a lot of different places. And the Indonesian ones kind of interested me most because that was the 10 smartest decisions a woman can make after 40, which is pretty focused on being your own person.
Uh-huh.
And that strikes me as interesting that they published that in Indonesia.
Well, I think that the world is more united in its outlook than we might think sometimes. And it's exciting to think that your knowledge, based on your experience, is going out there so far and wide.
It's very exciting. And it's really exciting every once in a while that I have no warning of this, but every once in a while a book package shows up with four or five copies, the author copies of a book in some foreign language, and sometimes I don't even have any idea what it is. And I have to dig through the book somewhere in there in tiny print. It says the city that it was published in, and that usually tells me what language it's in.
You must have a special
it's
shelf.
It's kind of an adventure.
Yes, you have a special shelf in your bookshelves for your books in translation.
I do.
That would be fun to look at. Tell us a little bit about how you came to move from your studies and practice in psychotherapy to book writing.
Well, it's an interesting story because it was an accident. I was studying. I didn't even have my license yet. I had my master's degree, and I was studying as a clinician, working with this group of people, and a colleague of mine and I, we all decided, a bunch of us students all decided to live in a house together. And we had a really hard time making decisions as a group, so my friend Riley and I worked up a cooperative problem-solving process, and then we presented it to the group. It worked so well. We presented it to the group, and somebody asked us to do a class at Los Angeles City College. We did a class there, and we were mobbed. We had hundreds of people in our class. They had to keep changing our room and stuff. We had people hanging out in the hallway. The title of the class was How to Be a Couple and Still Be Free, and it just hit a nerve. And we couldn't find a book on the shelves or in the library that said what we were talking about, which was cooperation instead of compromise, you know, working together to come up with a solution that makes everybody happy. instead of the majority rules, or, you know, whoever has the loudest voice gets their way or whatever. So we worked up a workbook for the class, and it was pretty primitive. In those days, you know, we had typewriters and photocopiers, and that was it. We didn't have computers, and all this was before 1980. And then we ran into a man who Riley used to know. He used to own a bookstore, now owned a publishing company, and was interested in publishing our book, so we had to write it up, get it into publishable form, and we did that, and he published it. It was Newcastle Publishing, which is no longer exists, but it became their bestseller. So that's how I got started writing books. And then the next book I wrote all by myself for Newcastle, and then I got invited to write for a bigger publisher, and I did that, and then it just kept going from there.
So your writing life started with a need that you fulfilled, yeah. And then you got invitations, it sounds like, to continue sharing your knowledge with the public via books.
Right.
And
right, and in the meantime, between the first book and the second book, I got licensed and started my practice. I had been getting hours, which is what you have to do. You have to get thousands of hours to become a therapist. So I was doing that, but I wasn't formally and licensed and in practice yet when the first book came out in 1980.
So I heard that little sigh. I was doing that. Most of us listening are thinking, wow, she's writing books, getting her hours in to become licensed as a psychotherapist, and then we'll have a practice and continue to write many more books. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you fit your writing life into the rest of your professional life.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because I'm haphazard, really. I just stick it in there, stick the writing time in there between everything else. I work out of my home. There are two rooms and a bath in my home that are dedicated to my counseling office and my computer office. And if I don't have a client, I can pop over to the computer office and get a little writing done.
So
I do it haphazardly like that. I have many writing friends, and a lot of them sit down at 9 o'clock in the morning and they work till 4 o'clock in the afternoon and all that. I've never had the luxury of being able to do that. So I write when I can write.
So it sounds to me like writing is not something you struggle with, that when you do have the minutes in between things to do it, you like to get down to it.
Yeah, I do. It's a wonderful adjunct for the therapy, because when I do therapy, I'm doing it kind of, it's seat of the pants kind of thing. You never know what's going to come through the door, what issues are going to be brought up or anything. So you have to think on your seat, I say, because I'm usually sitting down, and devise answers and exercises people can do and all that for the problems they bring in, and that's right off the top of your head. I mean, after a while, you get so you've heard this problem before, but there's always something new coming in. So the writing gives me an outlet for all of that seminal work I do while I'm doing counseling. When I write my books, I write them as though I'm talking to a client.
So you have some, perhaps, a face in mind when you're writing.
Yes.
And it sounds to me like that having to think quickly and listen deeply is helping you as a writer, because when we sit down to write, we might have an intention of what we want to write, but we actually don't know what's going to come through our fingers. And it sounds like you're comfortable with that kind of experience of not exactly knowing and then having an aha, look, I said something interesting.
Yeah, I'm really familiar with it. Every once in a while I'm in session, I have a pad of paper next to me, and I'll just jot something down. If I come up with an idea or a particular turn of phrase or something while I'm talking to a client, I jot it down, because it can be very helpful later on doing the writings.
So I know that your writing life and your professional life have led you to actually take great advantage of the internet. And there's a list of places where people can find and follow you and your work. You want to tell us some of your favorite ones? I'm sure they're all your favorite.
Well, I think the best thing to do would be to go to my website, which is tinatessina.com. That's TinaTessina.com. because on the home page of the website, there are links to everything else, my blog. There's a way to sign up for my newsletter, which comes out once a month. There's a link to my Facebook page and Twitter and LinkedIn and all of those things. I'm all over that place. So you can connect with me in many ways by just going to my website. That's the central
Tina, is that where we would find the podcasts and the online videos as well?
Yes. There are podcasts. There are online videos. There are articles. Most of the videos are on my blog, but that you can link to from the website. So it's all, if you go to the website, everything is there.
Thank you. And I think that you're prepared to read something of your work to us.
Yes. This is from the 10 Smartest Decisions a Woman Can Make After 40, which came out in January in ebook and paperback form. Here goes. In your lifetime, if you are 40 or older, you have gone from dial telephones to smartphones, typewriters to computers, and the internet has evolved from a primitive private network for computer experts and scientists to video calls, social media, and shopping on the web. In the workplace, jobs that require travel, telecommuting, and working on tablets and smartphones are now commonplace. Keeping up with the rapid pace of change we live in today, perhaps even defending yourself from it, requires a new kind of decision-making. In addition to keeping up with the technological evolution, you have responsibilities to meet at home, on the job, and in your personal life. If you feel overwhelmed at times and find that you simply can't find the time to devote to looking at the big picture, you are not alone. When you focus on the day-to-day details, you forget to plan ahead, to anticipate change, and before you realize it, some neglected aspect of your personal or family life is in crisis. It's time to stop briefly and take a look at where you are at this midpoint of your lifespan. If you spend a few productive hours reevaluating where you are and where you're headed, you can create a much more satisfying, productive, and fulfilling future for yourself and for those you love. Successfully recreating your life at this point involves several crucial factors. 1. Future security. Planning a secure future for yourself, if you have not done so already, is essential now. This involves getting appropriate financial advice and managing your money, something women and men of a certain age often feel unprepared for. But money isn't the whole picture. Making sure your lifestyle habits and attitudes are consistent with maintaining your personal health and well-being is crucial to making the coming years feel like a reward for all your hard work. 2. Changing roles. About this time in your life, you see shifts in your family's needs. The generation following you is growing up, and the generation before you is getting older. Your own generation has reached the point of maximum responsibility. Many 40-somethings find that just as they are being relieved of some of the responsibility for their children, they are taking on a burden of caring for aging parents or grandparents. Both of these factors impact your family decisions and your personal life in profound ways. The gift this stressful period gives is learning to handle all these changes successfully and effectively, keeping your life in balance, or perhaps achieving that balance for the first time. It also focuses you on your own long-term future. What will you do when you retire or reach the age of your parents? Satisfaction. After many years of being a responsible, hardworking adult, and especially for many women, focusing on taking care of others at home, at work, and in family relationships, many men and women find that they don't know what they want for themselves. It's time to learn how to make the decisions that create the enriched, satisfying experience you always hoped your life could be. When you do, you'll discover what satisfaction means for you and how to refocus your life to create more of it. 4. Enjoyment. Your ability to take pleasure in life, to lighten up, to find the fun in a simple moment, may have been suppressed over the years. For some of you, reconnecting with your lighthearted self may simply require an attitude change. For others, it requires major decisions to simplify and refocus your goals. Or it could be some combination. You can learn how to make the decisions that free you up to have more fun. When you use smart decisions and self-awareness to shape your life, it will reflect your deepest aspirations and your fondest dreams. The decisions you make determine the quality of your life, but you may not be sure which decisions are most important in your life or how to arrive at the best decision. The 10 Smartest Decisions focuses on 10 decisions that are most frequently needed by people in midlife and later. In the book, you'll learn how to decide to, 1, make your life your own, decide to redecide, re-examine your goals and dreams, 2, make your job a joy, decide to revitalize your career or try a new one, 3, take it to the bank, decide to secure your financial position and get out of debt and keep yourself on a budget, 4, why are you here, decide to create meaning in your life, identify the purpose and meaning of your life and define why you are here on earth, 5, share your bounty, decide to give something back. Donate money or put your talents, skills, and experience to use by volunteering for causes you care about.
Thank you, Tina. I feel like I just walked into a room where somebody understands me and where I am and what I think about. So I am, for one, eager to read about how to handle those decisions. It sounds very affirming, very encouraging. And I think from the titles of your other books that that's kind of your stance towards your reading public, is that there is something that you as author identify that many of us are thinking about, and you give us a structure for clarity.
Thank you. That's a lovely thing to say, and it's really what I do strive to do. At the time that I wrote the first book in this series, which is The 10 Smartest Decisions a Woman Can Make Before 40, somebody had come out with a book about 10 stupid decisions women make, and I thought, what is that going to help anybody? Calling them stupid and saying you screwed it up isn't going to help anybody. So my focus is always, of course, with my clients and in my books too, is always to try and help people, empower them, teach them skills that they may have missed learning at some point, give them a perspective that they can use right away today to start making things better. And I'd like to keep it as simple as possible too.
I think that's terrific. And it's true that I think the major publishers often really like to put out work that people scoff at and laugh at. It gives us some kind of release, but it doesn't really help. And I agree with you and think that it's so important to use our own professional training and our experience, our life experience, as well as professional experience to actually be of service. And I appreciate what you read so much. So people can sign up for your newsletter and see some excerpts of your work online.
Yes, at my website, tinatacina.com, there's a books page where they can go and see the tables of contents and information about the book, the book cover, and a link to buy the book. All my books are there, and there's even a page for my foreign books, so you can see all my foreign book covers if that gets you excited.
Yes, well, and, as a writer, that gets me very excited. and I want to say that you have a personal connection to us here in Port Townsend. You're speaking to us from Southern California. And
yes,
here in Port Townsend, your web designer is Charlie Fleischman, the resident here who is also the sound engineer for this program. It's very exciting.
God bless Charlie.
Yeah, it's very exciting to reach out with all of our connections and realize how connected we are no matter our geography. And your translations into 17 languages certainly demonstrates that. Is there anything you'd like to add before we end the program today?
Well, I want to say thank you for having me. It's wonderful to get to talk about the writing aspect, which is, I don't often get to talk about that angle on my books. And anybody who wants to write, you know, you just have to keep at it. I know you've heard that a million times from other writers, but the reason you hear it a million times is it's true. You just have to keep writing till you get somewhere. And there are, today it's so easy to publish an ebook. The hard part, of course, is marketing it, but you can get published pretty quickly and easily with all the technology we have online. So if you're interested in writing, go for it. It's worth doing, and it's a way to express yourself in a positive way.
It sounds like it's one of the 10 best decisions you can make after 40, if not before. It's interesting that you said keep at it. Your enthusiasm and experience make it sound like, and your interest in writing and your ability to just start doing it in between other commitments of your work life makes it sound like it's really easy. But I know that it's not easy for anybody. Writing is a process. So might you tell us a little bit about the kinds of things that you struggle with as a writer?
Yeah, well, I have a funny story because in 2008, I contracted to do two books with Adams Media. And for some reason, when they sent the contract for the first book, in the contract it said it was a work of 80,000 words, and they had put 80,000 words in bold type. Well, that completely freaked me out because it sounded like impossible. How can I ever write 80,000 words? So I didn't even look at the contract for 2 days. I put it away, and then I kind of sidled up to it and looked at it again, and I decided to figure out how many pages 80,000 words was. And it was a 200-page book, of which I'd written a bunch already. So, but in that format of 80,000 words, it was just frightening to me. So you have to be willing to rethink things. If you get afraid of something in your writing, just take another look at it from a different angle and rethink it. When I have gotten manuscripts just red-penciled all over the place, they don't do that anymore. I mean, it all comes through in by email now, but I used to get paper manuscripts with red pencil all over them, and that also would upset me and hurt my feelings and freak me out. And then I'd have to just stop and calm down, put it away for a day or two, and then take a look at it. And I usually found that the suggestions that the editor was making, and they are only suggestions, they're not like decimating your work, were good suggestions. And most of the time I agreed. And if I didn't agree, I had a voice and I could stand up and say, no, this is not what I intended to say. And you've changed the meaning and this doesn't work for me. But, you know, you have to kind of get your balance every once in a while. Things throw you off and you have to recalibrate, get your balance. Remember that you're doing this for a reason. Get in touch with your reason. And then it becomes okay again.
That's excellent advice. Do you find the same thing is true when you're thinking about how you structure a book? Do you that response you had to the 80,000 words made me think about sometimes we structure a book, we have it all laid out, we think it's going to work, and then we find out our structure is not exactly working for us. I'm wondering if you've had that experience.
Yeah, my structure never works.
Oh.
I always start with an outline, and it never works for me. I mean, it works in that it gets me focused, but I have to take the outline. And when I did my first book, you know, cut and paste was literally you cut with scissors, and you cut out chunks, and you paste them back in a different order. Now we blessedly have cut and paste on the computer. I use that a lot. I have to restructure how my thoughts flow because when I first do them, they don't flow in a logical order. So it never works for me, that first outline.
So how do you know it's not working? What's the thing that tells you you have to rethink it?
Well, I learned a long time ago that you write your books for the little lady in Peoria, is what they call it. No offense to Peoria, but that, you know, you have to remember who you're writing for. You're not writing for somebody who knows what you know. They want to know what you know. So you have to do it in a logical manner, that where one step flows from the next and not leave any steps out. And when you write something down and then reread it, you can, if you're thinking about that person who doesn't know any of this and wants to learn it, you can see where the steps don't mesh, where they can't get from step one to step three. There needs to be a step two in there.
Right. I find that I have to remember that writing is different than talking with somebody. If someone, the lady in Peoria, was there in the room with you, you would tell by her expression, her gestures, or her questions
exactly. What
she wasn't connecting. And when we're writing, we don't have that interaction going on. We have to invent it, like you're talking about.
That's right. You have to imagine. And it really helps to have other people read it, too. That's why editors are so wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't come up with his name now. A famous writer wrote a passage about editors are God in plain clothes.
Hmm.
And then he does a thing about, Bill, I don't know about this guy, this Swedish guy, maybe he should be Danish, and I don't know about his name. Maybe it shouldn't be Jack. Maybe it should be something a little more Danish-sounding, like maybe Hamlet. And, you know, and he does this whole thing about this editor getting Shakespeare sorted out, and that's really how it works. The reason I don't have trouble writing is because I write down just gibberish sometimes if I can't get it right the first time. Writing is so much about editing that you can't expect yourself to have it in good form the first time it goes down. Just get it out there, get it down, and then you can mess with it after.
That's such excellent advice. I mean, most of us think that a book we read is how our writing should come out. It should look like that from the get-go. Uh-huh. And we don't get the experience of knowing how hard that writer worked and that editor to get it.
No, that's
in that
right.
Final
Stephen
form.
King's books don't look great the first draft either.
It's a good thing to remember. And, you know, I'm thinking about when you said you used to get your manuscript in pages marked up in red pencil, and you would have to sometimes say to the editor, no, that what you're suggesting is not what I meant. That, too, is a clue that what you meant wasn't coming across. And so editors
exactly.
are some of those first trusted readers who tell us when that, but unfortunately sometimes editors invent what they think we're saying, whereas another kind of reader would just say, I don't get it. But I think instead of feeling criticized, it's a time and an opportunity to say, oops, this is one of those places where I didn't fill in the dots.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's what's valuable about it. When you have a pair of fresh eyes looking at it, they don't have your assumptions and your experience and your history and all that, and they have to take it from their own background and history. And so it looks different to them, and that's very, very valuable to a writer because you're going to have all sorts of eyes looking at it eventually, hopefully.
So are you working on something new now?
Yes, I'm working on Dr. Romance's Guide to Dating in the Digital Age.
Ooh. And do you develop some of your books from what you write online?
Oh, definitely. It goes back and forth. What I write online often comes from my books, and what I write online. I do a lot of answering reporters' questions, journalists' questions about, you know, they want to write an article for a magazine, they need an expert, I'm the expert. They ask me a question, and I have to come up with some information about that, much like I have to do with my clients who come in the door. So if that's new, then I can use that myself because the reporter's only going to use a snippet of it. So the whole thing that I've come up with to answer that question, I can use elsewhere, and often that's where my newsletter articles come from.
So it's nice to hear a writer saying that the world offers opportunity. If you think about it as a writer, almost everything you're doing offers you an opportunity to sit down and do some more writing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tina, it was wonderful to talk with you today. You make me excited about writing and excited about decision making. And I look forward to delving into your website and some of your books. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sheila. It was fun talking to you too.
Thank you.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Production coordinator is Mike Schlexer. Announcer is Kurt Vanderslice.